Your Honor, the only thing I can say is that I think that issue in terms of the contract interpretation needs to be fully fleshed out, which it isn't exactly in the record, because what's at issue here is the jurisdictional question of whether state or federal law controls. And without opportunity for further briefing upon a determination of that question, I'm not sure it would be in my client's interest to be able to articulate a complete position.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Howell.
May it please the court, my name is John Howell and I represent the intervener, Mr. Ronald Ezell Hood. Mr. Lippman's counsel started off with the period after the activity before this court. It seems that someone has lost sight of the fact that there was an appeal filed on July 20th of 2000, that on August 3rd, 2000, Mr. Lippman entered his appearance. I apologize for my voice. On the way. On December 11th, the VCAA miscellaneous order was filed. Mr. Lippman tried to continue to write his brief, and then the court moved to remand the case for consideration of the VCAA. On March 12, 2001, Mr. Lippman filed his opposition to the appellee's motion to remand. It would appear to Mr. Hood that the only thing that Mr. Lippman was concerned about was his EJA fee, and he had done very little about the...
But wouldn't an EJA fee reduce the... reduction from the 20% award?
It would.
Okay.
Mr. Lippman had not filed his brief, according to my chronology, that on January 16th, 2001, he moved to file his brief to February 11th. He again filed on February 6th, 2001.
Excuse me if I may interject. So would it be your position then that this court should look at in determining, if we were to get to the question of reasonableness of the fees, Mr. Lippman's representation at the court, you think that the language in the contract would include looking at the work that he's done at the court?
I would think so. The court remanded this over his objection, and this remand would appear to be in favor of Mr. Hood. And all through the file, it's been very clear that Mr. Lippman is interested in his EJA fee. And Mr. Hood is no dummy. And he said all this guy wants to do is get his fee.
But doesn't that EJA fee, as Judge Castle pointed out, redound to Mr. Hood's benefit in reducing the contingency
fee? It does. But Hood looks on it as, Mr. Hood and myself look on it as as more interested in money than in Mr. Hood's well-being. Now,
how do you deal with the contract provision that indicates that services before the court will be pro bono? And why then, to follow up on Judge Sholin's question, why is what was done or not done at the court relevant with regard to the follow-on question of the services provided by Mr. Lippman?
With the remand that he opposed, it vitiated his ability to get a pro bono or an EJA fee. And as soon as Mr. Hood heard about his opposition to the remand, it was his conclusion that he was not acting in his best interest, and he fired him. And so from that point on.
Yeah, but if that conclusion is not necessarily a reasonable conclusion either. I mean, if the remand had been based on a merits remand and EJIA fees were awarded, it would reduce the 20% reduction.
That's
now,
true.
I'm not saying the client can't make his call on the issues and so forth. We don't need to get into that issue. But you're presenting an argument that the attorney was acting contrary to the best interests of the appellant, and I'm not sure why that stands alone.
Well, because Mr. Hood perceived that...
But is his perception correct?
I would...
Ultimately, you get a... Ultimately, if the briefing had gone on and the remand had come up, you'd still get a remand for VCAA at a minimum.
Right.
It might be delayed a few months, but he gets a remand either way. The attorney says, I can get him EJIA fees if there's a merits one, and we can save an issue down below. Why is that unreasonable?
Because he didn't explain it to Hood, and Hood was saying that the only thing he's doing now is trying to get money, and he's not looking out for my interests. There's the old saying about there's three things that can happen when you file an appeal with any court, and two of them are bad. I think he was representing that approach.
So it's a lack of communication.
Most likely.
Because certainly you could have a communication where the attorney could make that all those representations, and a client might still say, fine, I don't want to waste the time. I'd rather get my remand now. And presumably that would control, and you would get the remand.
I think that would be appropriate.
But it'd be just as reasonable that a veteran could say, a few months doesn't matter. If the EJIA fees will cover and take half of it, that's fine with me.
But the problem was there was no communication, and Mr. Hood did not understand. And Mr. Lippman represented himself to Hood as being seeking an EJIA fee, and Mr. Hood did not understand
the standard then by which that whole factual assessment needs to be made, if it ever needs to be made? I think that's the issue that we're really trying to deal with here. Do we follow? Does somebody have to make those factual determinations, the ones that you've just averred to?
Well, he's the client, and Mr. Lippman could have argued with him. He could have presented all of these arguments we're hearing today.
And then
he didn't do it.
And then with regard to Mr. Lippman's request that the 20% contingency fee be delivered to him, there's no further inquiry required. It's just governed by
the
veteran's perception.
The veteran is the client, and if his perception is incorrect, that's the attorney's problem.
If I could ask a hypothetical question, let us assume that Mr. Lippman performed every service to further his client's interests, and the client nonetheless were to have fired him prior to the award of benefits. And then hired a subsequent attorney. How would you advocate that the determination of entitlement and amount of fees should be made? Assuming all went as it should, but Mr. Hood nonetheless changed representation. You know, he had a cousin graduating from law school, whatever.
You mean you're talking about the EJIA fee and the 20% fee and that?
Primarily the 20% fee. Let's just say there's two attorneys involved. There's no allegation of poor representation on behalf of either of them. How do you think that the determination of who gets what should be done?
I would say he could go with his contract, and he said he was willing to settle there for an EJIA fee, and that would be his compensation. And then
below.
I think if he had done representation below, he would get his 20% less the EJIA fee.
Okay, and the new attorney then wouldn't receive anything?
There wouldn't be any new attorney if he continued to go with it.
But under my hypothetical, I was saying that the client hired a second attorney.
As he did.
But I'm just saying, assuming that it was not because he was unsatisfied with Mr. Lippman, there was some other reason. And so, therefore, both attorneys did work. How should VA split the fee? Or should it?
Well, Mr. Lippman, from his contract, said that he would be willing to have the EJA fee.
For representation at the court.
Representation at the court.
But what about work done at the agency? I'm trying to assess how the agency can deal with a circumstance where there are two attorneys.
Well, the issue from my perspective, you know, rather than a hypothetical, because you're describing our situation.
I'm trying to figure out what the law should be as opposed to how your facts fit under the law. And so that's what I'm looking for your help to describe for me. How should the process be, considering that the regulations and the statute don't clarify a lot what happens in the context of two attorneys with regard to a fee?
My take on this subject is that Mr. Lippman had an agreement with Hood to get EJA fees for his work on obtaining a remand. The remand was a result of the VCAA and not part of his work. And Mr. Hood fired him for that and went looking for another attorney, of course. Since I have been into this, I have not made any claim on the 20%, and that
I have not asserted that you have, Counselor. I'm just trying to get to what your assertion of how the law should determine fees as opposed to how they should potentially be applied in your circumstance. Do you have anything to help me with that?
If I were to be considered for the 20%, I would go with, if Mr. Lippman got his EJA fee and then was fired, then that would leave a certain amount of money available and go from there.
And what would be done in the going from there?
That the attorney that followed Mr. Lippman
would be entitled to the entire 20%?
No. Would be as part of the, as fairness.
So there'd be some consideration of how much work was done, the quality of the work, those factors. So
as well as the fact that Mr. Lippman's contract said, okay, I'm going to get EJA fee, and then that's going to save you that amount of money.
Right.
I would think the follow-on attorney would have to live with that.
So you would look to the factors in the regulations that apply to VA in determining what is a reasonable fee. You would not look to a state law provision.
Well, you'd have to start with the VA regulations to begin with, and if they don't cover it, they should go to the state law provision, as they did in this case.
So you think looking to the state law in this case was appropriate?
I do.
If we were to remand this to the board for consideration of what is a reasonable fee, following on Judge Mormon's question and some I had earlier, what's your view of the phrase section of the sentence on page 175 of the record, page 2 of the agreement? That fees are not in connection with the pro bono appeal to the U.S. Court of Veterans Appeals. I thought I heard you say that they should consider the work that was done up here, but then the work was not much and therefore it's not worth it much. But should they consider the work that was done here at all, given that phrase, not in connection with the pro bono appeal to the U.S. Court of Veterans Appeals?
Because the EJA fee was designed to cover that part of it.
So they shouldn't consider that if they were to consider reasonableness.
I would agree.
You don't have to use all your time.
Okay.
I actually have another question.
Okay.
Your brief, you assert that perhaps sanctions should be levied against Mr. Lippman, and I'd like to explore that a little bit.
Okay.
One of the bases that you raise is that he has filed similar arguments in 15 other briefs or 15 other cases.
Yeah, whatever number that I was able to discover.
To what extent should, let's assume that that argument was in fact made and that the circumstances were the same as opposed to VA was supposed to pay the withhold the 20% and instead paid it all to the client or whatever. We have many attorneys who file similar arguments in many cases until that argument is confirmed to be a valid one by the court or struck down as not being a valid one by the court. The fact that it's been argued in other cases, what value should that be attributed by this court?
The reason that that was put in there was at the insistence of Mr. Hood, and because he was concerned about Mr. Lipman's activities with other veterans as well. And I found these various cases by looking through Westlaw and Lexis. Mr. Hood feels that Mr. Lipman was entirely in it for the money and didn't really care for his case, that he tried to continue his representation when he didn't get his EJIA fee because of the BCAA remand, and that Hood fired him for that because he did not feel that he was representing him as he should. When Mr. Hood first talked to me, he was very angry about Mr. Lipman. And so I looked at these cases and I suggested to him we might ask for sanctions. And he was very much in favor of that.
Is that a proper basis for sanctions, or is that something that should be brought before the disciplinary board if he has those feelings? The bar?
I would say either or both.
Do you have any support for why that would be proper basis for sanctions?
That's,
is there some disrespect to the court?
I'm sorry?
Is there some disrespect to the court?
No, I think it's a disrespect to the veterans that Mr. Hood was concerned about.
And is that a proper basis for sanctions? And do you have support for that?
No, I don't. I don't have any case law on that.
And should we look outside of his conduct in this case?
That's what I was suggesting in that brief. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. You still just have the 10 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Secretary. This is Mr. Sullivan.
Yes. May it please the court. Your honors, since I'm probably going to get asked the same question, I'm going to jump into the pool. And if we look at the terms of Mr. Lipman's fee agreement, the secretary would submit that Mr. Lipman would be entitled to apply for EJIA for his activities before this court. After such time, it would appear, based on the language of his contract, that he would be entitled to 20% of any past due benefits recovered down below. Now, that goes to the heart of the secretary's case here and why we argued for remand. We believe that that is a finding of reasonableness that would have to be made in the first instance by the regional office. And Skates tells us that that's what has to happen. And I think that would answer your concern, Judge Moorman. So the question of eligibility and reasonableness must be looked at in conjunction with each other. Part of the problem with the board decision before us today is that we have an eligibility determination in a vacuum. And not only is it an eligibility determination in a vacuum with regard to Mr. Lipman, it makes no eligibility or reasonableness determination with regard to Mr. Howell's contract. Now, the board relied exclusively on Colorado law.
But didn't Mr. Howell waive fees?
Indeed, he did.
So that issue is no longer here.
It's kind of a tough question to answer, but I would pose it this way, my answer this way. I would suggest that to the extent that the court or at the regional office, findings have to be made with regard to the eligibility and reasonableness of Mr. Lipman's contract, because they both potentially share in the fee, findings have to be made with regard to Mr. Howell's contract.
And then
so whether or not he may or may not waive, that there may come a time that he can indeed do that. But I think those findings have to be made in the first instance, because findings that are made with regard to Mr. Howell's contract, I think you would all agree, are certainly in this particular case going to affect the reasonableness and the eligibility under Mr. Lipman's contract.
Well,
What law controls with regard to eligibility for fees? You know, is this federal law? Is it state law? And then I'll tell you the question right behind that is, what law controls with regard to reasonableness?
Your Honor, I believe that Skates is very strongly suggestive here that federal law occupies this field, that 5904 and its implementing regulation, 20.90 or 609.
Well, Skates asks a question, right?
Well, it
says, it couldn't federal law apply here?
It does ask that question, but in order to make the findings that it does, that the regional office needs to make findings in the first instance, the Federal Circuit implies that 5904 and 20.609 occupy the field.
Okay, and what's the Secretary's position with regard to that? Because right now, the only secretarial position that I see is that it ought to be remanded.
We did not argue a position in our brief because we felt very strongly, Your Honor, that the case probably should go back for findings at the lower level. That because the board...
Findings as to what law applies?
Well, findings with regard to the legality and the terms of the contracts, findings with regard to eligibility, reasonableness, etc. If we look at the four corners of the board decision, the board relied exclusively on the law of the state of Colorado. It made no citation to the Colorado revised statutes. It made no citation to Colorado case law. It just essentially gave a verbatim recitation of the opinion that was provided to the board.
This court would review any determination with regard to the law that's applicable de novo, wouldn't it?
That's correct. Absolutely. So, and this court, as
so
it sits
what position,
today...
What position would the secretary urge on the court?
The secretary would urge on the court today that based on Skates, based on the statutory scheme, that federal law should govern in this instance.
With regard to both eligibility and...
That is correct. That is correct. The secretary would submit that given the facts before us here, there probably is no reason for a resort to Colorado law. And that was error on the board's part. It certainly was error, as we framed it in our brief, that not to consider the application of federal law at all. So certainly we presented our argument to the court in such a way to say that the board is required to argue all or address all potentially applicable laws. In the absence of a thorough vetting of Skates and its implications, in the absence of any discussion of 20.609 and the reasonableness factors, that the board decision is fatally flawed, and that
but
it would
have
to go
down. But you
didn't
get to reasonableness factors if he wasn't eligible.
That's true, but...
And the board made a determination that state law was applicable here and that he was not eligible, and under those circumstances, you're suggesting they erred because they didn't discuss the federal law.
That's...
And you would have us remand it for determination by the board as to whether federal law or state law applied, only to have it come back here, presumably, for a determination de novo as to which law applied.
That is correct. But as I indicated to Judge Moore,
so what's gained by sending it back to the board for determination which law applies?
Well, I think initially the secretary viewed this matter as if it went back down, it takes the issue away from the court and it allows the secretary to look at his statutory and regulatory scheme and make a policy decision. Now, the secretary fully recognizes that this court sitting today can make a de novo finding that federal law applies. And the secretary has no heartburn over
that.
State
law.
Now,
or that state law applies.
Yes, but in that instance, we would contend that the case still has to go back. It would still have to go back if you make a de novo finding that federal law would apply, because there is no explanation of federal law in the document. So it would have to go back down.
But if state law applied on eligibility, it would not have to go back, if we agreed with the board that he was not eligible.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think it would. I think it would have to go back because
the court found that state law was applicable, and the board made the determination that he was not eligible under state law because state law required quantum merit, et cetera. Why would we send it back?